is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. Sincerely yours, Robert Mueller. That's how the special counsel signed a letter to Attorney General William Barr at the end of March. Now it's May, and it's Barr's sincerity that's in question. Mueller's note was a revelation about the special counsel's disappointment that Barr's summary of the Russia report misled the public. The letter came to light just a day before Barr testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee and 2 days before he refused to speak in front of the House Judiciary Committee. The AG is now facing calls from Democrats for him to resign, be impeached, or be held in contempt of Congress. But what does this week's drama on the Hill mean for the president? We have so many questions. We know that you do, too. So without further ado, let's dive into the Friday News Roundup. Joining me this week is Mark Fisher. He's senior editor with The Washington Post. Mark, great to have you here.
Good to be here.
Kimberly Adams is here, correspondent for Marketplace. Kimberly, what a pleasure.
Thanks, Todd.
And Josh Gerstein is here, senior legal affairs contributor for Politico. Hey, Josh.
Nice to be with you, Todd.
Well, Josh, let me start with you. What did you take away from this week, William Barr on Capitol Hill in both the Senate and very glaringly not in the House?
Well, I was struck by the degree to which, once again, Attorney General Barr did President Trump's bidding. He went to the witness table there in the Senate, and he again portrayed the president as a man whose anger about the Mueller probe was righteous. This is an attack that Barr took in the first press conference that he had announcing the imminent release of the Mueller report. While he got into a lot of tangles with Democratic members, it was very clear that this is a lawyer who, as attorney general, is going to be advancing the president's interests. And that was really what struck me as the main takeaway, because there were people when Barr came into office who thought, okay, he's a very conservative attorney. He's clearly like a lifetime Federalist Society achiever. But we might have a very detached analysis of the law here. And I think a lot of people after these series of appearances are saying that's not exactly what we're getting.
Mark Fisher, what was the big picture for you?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to what Josh says, but it's also true that Bill Barr is someone who was chosen not for his personal loyalty to Donald Trump, but because he had a set of principles that happened to mesh with the president's needs at this point, which is Bill Barr is a strong believer in the power of the president, the power of the executive. And so he was kind of making that argument as much as it was a personal defense of Donald Trump. You watch this thing and it looks like he's doing the president's bidding. And indeed, he is the president's appointee. And attorney generals, whether they are Bobby Kennedy, the brother of the president, or others who have strong political alignment with the president, they do tend to support the president. We have this notion that the chief law enforcement officer of the country should be distanced and should, have that as the priority over the politics, but that's not the way it's generally worked in American history.
Kimberly, attorney generals do generally support the president, but they don't always go in front of Congress or in front of the press and echo the president's language using the word collusion. I don't know how many, 30 or 40 times, using the word spying to describe FBI investigations when there was evidence that Russia was all over the Trump campaign, and they were. So there's something different here.
There is something different, and the Democrats haven't quite seemed to come up with a unified way to respond. You have some, as you mentioned, some people calling, saying we should, hold him in contempt. Then what? What happens then? There's a dubious understanding of what then would happen if, say, he refused or Trump pardoned him or something like that. And this is increasing calls for impeachment, which Speaker Pelosi has been trying to tamp down. And there's a real sense that Barr is kind of working them over in these hearings and they don't quite know how to respond.
And I want to make sure we get to the big picture of what's in the report and how overseers and Democrats react on Capitol Hill and what's at stake. Let's go back to Wednesday, though, just to make sure we review exactly what William Barr had to say to the Senate Judiciary Committee when he gave some of the justifications for his interpretation of the Mueller report.
We prepared the letter for that purpose, to state the bottom line conclusions. We used the language from the report to state those bottom line conclusions. I analogize it to announcing after an extended trial what the verdict of the trial is, pending release of the full transcript. That's what we were trying to do, notify the people as to the bottom line conclusion. We were not trying to summarize the 410-page report.
Josh Gerstein, Democrats want to know, if that's true, why did Bob Mueller write to you, Bill Barr, and say essentially, call it a summary, call it a summation, call it whatever you want. The public is misled about what I found.
Right. And this is one of the points that ended up getting Barr in trouble. He had, in a previous appearance on Capitol Hill, been asked if he had any idea what was leading to news stories saying that members of Mueller's staff were upset with the way he portrayed the report in his initial letter to Congress about it. And he gave an answer where he said, no, he really didn't know that. He suspected or thought that maybe there were people on the staff that thought he should have put out more information. But he suggested in his response, this was in response to a question from Representative Charlie Crist of Florida, that he was a little bit mystified by the claims that had appeared in the newspaper. And now we know that he not only had was aware of the complaints from the special counsel, had gotten this very unusual letter from Robert Mueller saying he objected to the way the report had been framed. And there'd been several other communications, a personal phone call and some other contact with the special counsel's office. So Barr came under fire from Democrats for, at a minimum, misleading them, and other Democrats saying that he actually lied to the Congress.
Kimberly?
And in that clip, Barr was saying, you know, he wasn't trying to summarize it. Well, he didn't actually need to, because as Mueller laid out in the letter, he had an executive summary and documents that he did want to release to the public.
You know, I think what's happening with Bill Barr is he appears to be this sort of old school Washington figure, very tamped down, low-key demeanor, a bit ironic and all of that. And yet what I think Donald Trump values about him is that he's also a New York street fighter. They're both from the city and they have that that sort of gutter kind of instinct. And that, so their styles are different, but I think Bill Barr is someone who is going to fight for both his principles and this president. And the Democrats are stuck here because on the one hand, you have a public that now accepts the Mueller report, large majorities in recent polls saying that they accept the findings of the Mueller report, and they believe that Donald Trump lied, and yet at the same time, support for impeachment is declining. And the large majority now says, forget the impeachment thing, move on, talk about some issues. So the Democrats find themselves in a very difficult place here. They're sort of morally driven to go after the president, and yet, on the other hand, that's not what the public wants.
And let's hear from the person who exemplified that dilemma in the Congress this week. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was asked by a journalist whether the Attorney General had committed a crime when he did what you talked about, Josh, failed to disclose Robert Mueller's concerns over his summary when asked by lawmakers. Here's what the speaker said.
He lied to Congress. He lied to Congress. If anybody else did that, it would be considered a crime. Nobody is above the law, not the President of the United States and not the Attorney General. Being the Attorney General does not give you a bath to go say whatever you want, and it is the fact because you are the Attorney General.
Now, therein lies the dilemma, Josh Gerstein, because the Speaker of the House herself has tamped down expectations of impeachment of the president, asked directly about the Attorney General, used very strong language. That is a bold charge. Lying to Congress is a crime.
Yeah, and it seems to me like there's a bit of a dance going on here with the Democrats, where you have them saying things that they want to say to satisfy their base, people who are extremely concerned about the president's conduct with respect to Russia and with respect to the 2016 election. And then, as Mark was saying, other people who are more interested in hearing about issues that could sort of frame the upcoming presidential campaign. And that tension is going back and forth. We also saw at these hearings on Capitol Hill various presidential candidates who had a moment to ask questions of Barr and use that opportunity, I think, to try to get into some kind of a heated exchange with him. There's clearly a lot of pressure among Democrats to try to be seen as the most confrontational and the person that's really sticking it to the Trump administration.
We got this comment from A, who wrote us an email. No, the AG is just following the law here. Get over it and move on. Stop seeing things that aren't there. And Kimberly, I think that reflects the attitude not only of a lot of Republicans on the Hill, but also if you watch Fox News, the president wasn't charged. No collusion, no collusion, no collusion. That's it.
It may be, at least according to the Attorney General, but one of the reasons that the Democrats in Congress keep hammering in on that is some of the things that were revealed in the Mueller report about the behavior of the presidents. And there are still many, many ongoing investigations in Congress from which, you know, there are going to be more documents. I mean, they're going after some of the financial records of the Trump administration. There's all these counter lawsuits happening back and forth. And so even if this is done, which I think the writer is correct, that the Democrats really don't want to let go of this, it also is spawning all of these other things for which the Democratic Party thinks there are real legitimate, in some ways, constitutional concerns.
Mark Fisher, we're going to take a quick break. Don McGahn, the White House counsel, is also at question. He's been called by the House. Are we ever going to hear from him?
I don't know. I think I think he probably wants to speak. And the president has made it clear that he does not want his former White House counsel to speak to Congress. It's not clear how much control the White House has. Donald McGahn is now a private citizen. He could come forward, but the president can claim executive privilege and say that all of what he would talk about is stuff that was protected by the executive privilege. So that's going to be an interesting legal confrontation.
We got this from Catherine in Mechanicsville, Virginia, who asked, what was the motivation behind Mueller's letter? What did he think his letter would accomplish if the attorney general is supposed to have the ultimate power over the decision to prosecute a case or not? Was it sent to allay his regrets that his conclusions about obstruction were too oblique? That's one question we're going to get to after the break. And we're also going to talk about the larger issues, the confrontation between the executive and the legislative. It's 1A, the Friday News Roundup. Stay with us. It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick with you. It's our weekly tradition of looking back on some of the biggest news stories from recent days, talking about how they might shape the days ahead. With me for the Friday News Roundup, Marketplace correspondent Kimberly Adams. Josh Gerstein is here, senior legal affairs contributor for Politico, and Washington Post senior editor Mark Fisher. We got this message from Ginny in LaPorte, Indiana. Our Constitution is being trampled on by this president, his administration, and the attorney general. To defy coming to Congress is frightening, and there's no respect for our rule of law by this president. That's Ginny's view. I want to play you, gang, the view from Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham, who spoke to reporters after some of the hearings this week.
Why not call for Mueller to testify?
Because I'm not going to do any more. Enough already. It's over. If there's any dispute about a conversation, then he'll come. But I'm not going to retry the case. I'm not calling McCann. It is over.
Mark Fisher, the Republican chairman of the Judiciary Committee, says he's done.
Well, he may be done, but neither the president nor the Democrats are done. So I'm not sure that Lindsey Graham's view on this has terribly much relevance. In fact, we're going to see this continue because it's in the interests, in the perceived interests of both the Democrats and the president to keep this going. The president loves the provocation. He loves the argument, the confrontation. And the Democrats are playing right into it because they want that, too. They want to see this administration declared a rogue administration. And Donald Trump is happy to wear the mantle of being the rogue president.
Josh,
so,
go ahead.
Well, I just think the Democrats haven't thought through the psychology of Donald Trump and how much he relishes exactly what they're doing.
And, Josh, if you watch this story through the bubble of Fox News, closely allied with the White House, this story isn't about Trump and Russia at all. This story is about the deep state sending pro-Hillary spies to spy on the Trump campaign. It's a completely different story, and they're running it.
Right, and we did have further disclosures about that this week, that it appears that there may have been as many as two people sent by the FBI to try to reach out to George Papadopoulos when he was a foreign policy advisor, rather young foreign policy advisor for the Trump campaign, but an advisor nonetheless, as part of what appears to have been an FBI effort to figure out whether there was something going on with the Russians and Hillary's emails and the Trump campaign. And I do have to say, I don't think the Republicans' concerns on this and the White House's concerns are completely unwarranted. To send undercover operatives, or at least one undercover operative, at a U.S. presidential campaign to try to gather information in the midst, the height, at the very height of the campaign, right around the time of the political conventions in 2016, is an extraordinary thing, perhaps something that's never happened before in American history.
It's a big decision, and it's a tough decision to decide to do that because there are political implications, interference implications all over that. On the other hand, I am not a lawyer, but I look at this very question. If you have reason to believe, good reason to believe, that an adversary, the Russians, are all over this campaign, and our intelligence community and the Mueller report have both concluded, yes, they were, was the alternative of doing nothing a responsible option?
Not necessarily, but I think it is important for us to know at what level in the government was that decision made? What facts did people have in front of them at the time they made the decision? Were those facts accurate? You know, we have these issues regarding the Steele dossier now that's been shown to be at least partially inaccurate in several material respects, and it appears that that played into some factor in this operation that the FBI conducted. It's not clear if that involved this outreach that was made to Papadopoulos or just some of the electronic surveillance that was done. And there is a review underway at the Justice Department by the Inspector General, who's sort of the internal, sort of semi-independent watchdog in the Justice Department, as to how this whole investigation got started. Were things handled properly? Were they cleared at the right levels? And just the kind of judgments that you're talking about, Todd. And I'm not saying that one answer is right or one answer is wrong, but it does seem a worthy subject to at least explore how something like that would happen, because you could see how that kind of power could be abused against members of another opposition political party quite easily in the future.
Kimberly, you alluded to all the other investigations going on by oversight committees and various committees on Capitol Hill. And the strategy from this White House now is complete and utter stonewall, right? Former White House officials, no, you shouldn't testify. That's privileged. You will not see my tax returns. I will try to block you from talking to Deutsche Bank. I will prevent any White House personnel from answering subpoenas. Basically a blanket no. Where does this go between an executive and a Congress when they're not even fighting over individual subpoenas? It's just no.
Well, I think we should first look at where it comes from, which is Trump as a real estate businessman. You know, he ran on this, and this was his strategy in New York. You don't like something, you sue, you stall, do whatever you can, and just eventually wear people down. And unlike in the business world, he's got a set time. He just has to wear the Democrats down until. He just has to stall them until the 2020 election. And as we've heard, there is plenty of narrative to support his case to his supporters all the way up into them. They tried to infiltrate my campaign, and they did this, and they did this. As much as the Democrats think they can take what came out of the Mueller report and what's coming out of these investigations to wear down the president over time, 2020 is that election is a ways away, and people are already tiring of it. Now, to the constitutional question of what it means for the executive to just ignore the demands of Congress, I mean, what you're hearing from the Democrats in the House is that he's trying to make Congress an unequal branch of government. And I think what this is revealing is that we don't necessarily have the tools to counteract this right now.
Mark Fisher, one listener asks about Don McGahn or others. What if they decide to testify over the president's objections? Don McGahn is the former White House counsel. Can he be stopped from going on the Hill? What if he decides to do it?
Well, the White House can tell him you may not speak about matters that were between you and the president. We're asserting executive privilege. I would imagine, not a lawyer, but I would imagine that Don McGahn could go to Congress and say whatever he wants to say. But could he be held in contempt if he doesn't testify? Yes. Could the White House take action against him if he does? That's not as clear. They can certainly try to instruct him. And he has no history of being a rogue White House counsel. So it's hard to see where that ends.
I feel like maybe we have the next document we want to look at is Don McGahn's non-disclosure agreement, and if he signed one with the president directly.
And do those have any real power?
Right.
Because Donald Trump has always forced everyone around him to have those NDAs.
Well, before we let this go and move on to other news of the week, I want to step back from the back and forth just for one second, because Democrats have a political choice to make. Josh, you referred to it, about impeachment of the president or the attorney general. But what's at stake if they essentially legally do nothing? I mean, the Mueller report does not recommend the president be charged with a crime, but it details several instances where the president endeavored to obstruct an investigation. What message will President Trump take if there's no accountability?
Well, I mean, I do think that there are a lot of tools that Congress has at its disposal here, actually, to fight back against the president. The question is, do they want to do that? Do they want to escalate? And right now, all we're seeing, while there is this sort of squabbling in court about various issues and getting access to information, and I spend a lot of my time covering that stuff, I have to say that's a rather milquetoast response to what the president is alleged to have done here. To go to court and say we're going to ask a judge to order that you turn some information over is relatively mild. There are other things Congress can do. Congress can throw the attorney general in jail and lock him up in the basement of the Capitol. Congress can shut down the government. Congress can try to impeach, as you're saying, Todd, can try to impeach the attorney general. And yet there seems to be some reluctance among Democrats. They seem very happy to talk about all these things, but not necessarily to actually take concrete steps in that direction, probably for the reasons Mark is saying, that they fear there might be some backlash, particularly from moderate voters looking ahead to the 2020 campaign, that might be seen as overdoing it and too much of a distraction from other major challenges the country's facing.
Well, we saw some of that psychology play out before our very eyes, because one thing Democrats did do in reaction this week was go down to the White House and have very productive, apparently, and friendly negotiations with the president of the United States over an infrastructure bill. $2 trillion worth, the Democrats said. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer said they were willing to negotiate with the president over a giant infrastructure spending package. Here's the Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer.
It was a very constructive meeting. It's clear that both the White House and all of us want to get something done on infrastructure in a big and bold way. And there was goodwill in this meeting, and that was different than some of the other meetings that we've had, which is a very good thing.
Mark Fisher, cognitive dissonance is what I was feeling. A Congress going at the president for being lawless, obstructing justice, blocking subpoenas, blocking not showing his tax returns, turning around and negotiating in good faith, apparently, with the president over $2 trillion that he wants.
Well, this started out as this sort of ray of sunshine and a rare bit of actual bipartisanship from the deep, dark past. And if you look at the polling numbers, 76% of Democrats, 73% of Republicans, 70% of independents all want this to be an important priority, that infrastructure spending. And then the president agrees to have a session with the Democrats where there are no cameras. He's not going to pull any tricks on them. He was quiet afterwards. It seemed like a new dawn. And then within hours after they come out all sunshiny, Nancy Pelosi is comparing the president to Richard Nixon. Donald Trump is tweeting that the Democrats are guilty of treason, and we're back to the same old, same old. And so this sort of hurling of nasty one-liners reminds us that this infrastructure thing is going nowhere. It's going nowhere for two reasons. Number one, the politics that I just described, and number two, money, because they don't remotely agree about how to raise the money, that $2 trillion.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A. Well, Saul posted this on our Facebook page. Details, details. Where is the money going to come from, Mark Fisher? How much will actually appear? What will be required? When will the repairs be done? Which ones will be done first? Agreement in principle is one thing. The details, Kimberly Adams, are the devil.
The details are the death in this case, because already the Republicans have basically put a wash on this, saying, you know, we are not going to come up with any, we're not going to allow this to be funded by more deficit financing. And at the same time, the Democrats want to roll back the tax cuts to help pay for an infrastructure bill, which, again, the Republicans say isn't going to happen. And if you think about $2 trillion over 10 years, let's say, you're talking about, like, what, $200 billion a year, and it's a lot of money. And even if you raise the gas tax the way that some people are talking about, that only could go for, say, highways and bridges. What are you going to do about the water infrastructure that needs to be repaired? Trump in the past has expressed support for public-private partnerships. He's moved away from that. Even the people who do like public-private partnerships, which is allowing private companies to work with local and federal governments to fund these infrastructure projects, admit that those tend to only fund the profitable things, like a toll road. Nobody's going to do a public-private partnership to build a new sewer system in a rural area.
I want to take a pause and talk about another story that's important and kind of gets us very much out of the back and forth in Washington. There was a report from the Anti-Defamation League released this week that says that anti-Semitism has reached near historic levels in 2018. The ADL tracks anti-Semitic incidents. It found that physical assaults against Jews more than doubled last year, and that includes the murder of 11 Jews at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh last year. There was another tragic scene, of course, this week at a synagogue this past Saturday. A gunman opened fire at Shabbat services at Chabad Poe Synagogue outside of San Diego in California. The rabbi there, Rabbi Israel Goldstein, described the scene to CNN.
Most of my congregation was alive, with the exception Lori Kay is laying there on the floor. Her husband, Dr. Howe, is trying to resuscitate her. He passes out and faints. Their daughter, Hannah, comes out leaning over her parents on the floor. A sight out of the pogrom days, a sight out of the Holocaust Kristallnacht days. This doesn't belong in Poway, California. This does not belong in the United States of America. We have the constitutional rights to be free people, to practice religion in freedom. We came here running from the darkness of the Holocaust to a safe haven to be free people. And now we're being gunned down in our house of worship.
Josh Gerstein, what more can you tell us about this incident?
Well, this is yet another incident that we've seen in the last couple years of extremist hate-driven violence. And there remains some significant debate, I think, about the role that the Trump administration and feelings that seem to have been unleashed by President Trump's campaign and election has played in these episodes. I do think there are many factors that are at work. Some of it has to do with the internet and social media and the ability of people to access what were previously very, very marginal opinions. I remember when I came to Washington in the early 1990s, there were, of course, people around that had anti-Semitic views. There were treatises and tracts, but mostly these were being handed out like at a subway entrance. And people's ability to distribute that kind of information was really quite limited and kind of mechanical. And now we're in an era where we see this stuff really flourish in social media. You had Facebook, for example, this week take down a bunch of what they considered extremist anti-right sites. So I think that's another factor here. And then the availability of weapons seems to be a factor as well. You have a situation where it seems quite easy for someone to go in and where you might have seen in the past some kind of a violent incident with a handgun or a stabbing or something like that. Someone can go in with an automatic weapon and just cause a complete massacre.
Kimberly, we're going to talk about another mass shooting that happened this week at UNC Charlotte in just a few minutes. But this is gun violence of a different kind, as Josh was describing, spurred on by online white nationalist radicalization.
Right, which is a group that the Trump administration has faced a great deal of criticism for not even allowing the government agencies to look into white nationalism in the same way that they look into other types of terrorist groups or other types of groups that may do violence in the United States. And, you know, it's the rabbi's words were just so incredibly tragic. And this is one of the reasons that the tech industry is facing a lot more scrutiny from Congress and regulators now to try to control this kind of speech online.
We're going to take a quick break in just a moment. When we get back, we'll get reactions in Minnesota to the controversial conviction of a former police officer there. And we say goodbye to a Hollywood director who made a big impact in his short time behind the camera. Meanwhile, the Billboard Music Awards were this week. Drake took home the top artist honor. Taylor Swift opened the show with her new song, Me, in a glittery outfit accompanied by onstage marching bands, and it reminded a lot of people, maybe too many people, of Beyoncé's now legendary Coachella performance. And now, not surprisingly, the Swifties and the Beehive are at war on social media. Give the word to Taylor Swift there. Taylor Swift says, me, me, me. How appropriate. More on the roundup in just a moment. Stay close. I'm Todd Zwilla.
Never find another like me. I'm the only one.
Welcome back to 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Let's get to a few more stories with the time we have left on this Friday news roundup. My guests are Politico senior legal affairs correspondent Josh Gerstein, Washington Post senior editor Mark Fisher, and Marketplace correspondent Kimberly Adams. I want to turn now to our 1A Across America partner, Minnesota Public Radio, because on Tuesday, a jury convicted former Minneapolis police officer Mohammed Noor of third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter for shooting a civilian who called 911. This case has drawn international attention because Noor, the cop, was black. The person he's convicted of killing, Justine Ruschick, was a white woman from Australia. John Collins of Minnesota Public Radio has been following the trial, joins us now to explain the gravity of this conviction. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a brief recap of the circumstances surrounding this shooting? Who is Mohammed Noor and why did he end up shooting the woman who called the police?
Sure. Justine Ruschick is the woman who called the police. She was 40 years old, originally from Australia, and she lived in a pretty safe, affluent part of Minneapolis. And on the night of July 15, 2017, she heard a sound in the alley. She said to dispatch that sounded like a woman being assaulted. So she called 911. Now, Mohammed Noor was a Minneapolis police officer, and he and his partner responded to Justine Ruschick's 911 call, and he was a passenger in that squad car. Noor testified that they drove down the alley, he and his partner, their lights off, they listened, didn't hear anything, stopped at the end of the alley, and they were about to leave when Justine Ruschick approached the squad car. Now, there's a little bit of controversy about exactly what happened here, but Noor testified that there was a thump on the squad. He said his partner shouted, "Oh, Jesus," tried to pull his gun out. Noor testified that he saw fear in his partner's eyes, looked out the window, saw blonde hair and a pink T-shirt, assessed it as a threat, and fired once out the driver's side window from the passenger seat. He hit Ruschick in her lower abdomen, and she died at the scene.
How big of a surprise to the community and the people watching this trial was this verdict?
Well, you never know what a jury is going to do, but there had never been an officer convicted before in Minnesota for taking someone's life while on the job. So it was unprecedented. But one other officer previously had been acquitted on manslaughter charges. But in this case, prosecutors really aggressively tried the case. They bulked up the investigation. So by the end of the trial, it looked like a guilty verdict on at least one of the charges was a possibility.
John, there's been criticism that a white officer who shot a black man, Philando Castile, was acquitted of manslaughter, but a black officer who shot a white woman was convicted of third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. And both of these officer shootings happened in the Twin Cities region there in Minnesota. So what's been the reaction from various communities who have a real stake in this trial?
Right. For a lot of the activists who have pushed for this sort of police accountability for years, it's kind of bittersweet. On one hand, they say they want police officers to be held accountable for taking someone's life, and they want Justine Ruschick and her family to get justice. And on the other hand, they say the racial makeup of the cop and the victim in this case and how aggressively it was prosecuted is one more sign that the criminal justice system has inequitable treatment for people of color.
Well, here's Nikema Levy, a civil rights attorney and activist there in Minnesota.
Former Officer Noor was not humanized in the same way that we've seen other officers humanized. Justine Damon wasn't demonized in the same way that we see black victims demonized when they've been shot and killed by police. And so this whole thing stinks to high heaven.
John, sentencing is still to come in this case. What do you expect next?
Well, sentencing's happening next month, and Noor is facing about a 12-year possible sentence, according to the guidelines. In the meantime, I expect that there's going to be a lot of focus on what went wrong here, both in the shooting and the investigation that followed, because the testimony in this trial exposed really deep problems in the Minneapolis Police Department and its response, and in the state Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which did the investigation. So problems in how they investigated and how they conducted themselves during this. So Governor Tim Walz, Minnesota governor, has already said that he's going to push for a deep look into what happened with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And I expect that other people are going to make some calls for real substantial changes to how these agencies deal with, investigate, and prosecute fatal police shootings in the state.
John Collins is class and criminal justice reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. He's also co-creator of the award-winning podcast 74 Seconds about a white officer shooting and killing Philando Castile. John, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Well, folks here around the table with me, let's turn to North Carolina and the students at UNC, because there was another shooting that we should talk about at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Join the growing ranks, students there, of Americans who've been involved in mass shootings. A gunman opened fire on the campus Tuesday night. He killed two people and wounded four others. The heroics of one of the victims stood out. 21-year-old Riley Howell tackled a gunman and lost his life in the process. The chief of Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department, Kerr Putney, says Howell's sacrifice undoubtedly saved lives. Howell's girlfriend says he's a hero. The 22-year-old gunman waived his right to appear in court on Thursday afternoon, and law enforcement officers there still have not identified a motive for the shooting. I want to move us now on to the NRA, the National Rifle Association, who had a big confrontation and a shakeup within the last week. The NRA board voted unanimously this week to reelect Wayne LaPierre as chief executive. It also ousted former president Oliver North. This all comes after a bitter internal feud. We covered it on the show this week between LaPierre and Ollie North that played out in front of everybody at the organization's annual convention. Mark Fisher, does any of this suggest that the NRA's power is actually vulnerable? We're so used to thinking them as a juggernaut.
Well, internally, they're in disarray. They have financial problems. They have leadership problems that came to the fore this week. And so as you look at it as an institution, they've got some real troubles, and they're stuck arguing about what their basic message should be, all of that. That said, the NRA is not subject to the vicissitudes of rising and falling membership the way other large organizations like the AARP or the AAA might be. The NRA feeds on controversy, feeds on, much like President Trump, on rallying their base to this core sense of the rest of society being against them. Belonging to the NRA is not so much about owning a gun or sportsmanship. It's really about being part of a subculture of America. And so the NRA, even if it were to completely collapse, would still have that following. And that is absolutely crucial to their identity. They are a club where the internal politics of the place almost hardly matter.
Josh Gerstein, do you agree with Mark Fisher that if you're at the NRA, there's really no such thing as bad publicity?
I tend to agree that the NRA, when people think of it as incredibly powerful because of the amount of money that it has or the money that it donates or arranges to be donated to candidates, people are kind of missing the point. I mean, it's succeeded as a grassroots movement that has managed to convince its members and to play off its members' fears and concerns about efforts to ban guns and the notion that different politicians were going to take steps to rein in Second Amendment rights. And that's really what has been their rallying cry. I think what we've seen over the past few weeks is really a byproduct of an organization that has been able to flourish financially off of that movement. And I think their budget is somewhere between $300 and $350 million a year. And so if you look at it that way, it's perhaps not surprising that there would at least be allegations from some people that someone is trying to siphon off some of that money in one direction or another. Maybe the surprising thing is that we haven't heard about this before, and that the organization has managed to keep those kinds of internal frictions and rifts sort of under the carpet up to this point.
Still, Kimberly, this is an organization who, it was reported, poured $55 million into 2016, $30 million to President Trump himself. We're told over and over that fundraising is way down, membership is way down. I got two guys on either side of you who say in some ways it might not matter, even when you look at the numbers, because the NRA is so entrenched in American political culture.
Maybe so, but there have been, especially in the last couple of weeks as all this has played out, a lot of members stepping in and saying, you know what, the NRA has moved too far away from its core goal. Like, we're supposed to be protecting the Second Amendment, not getting into all of these cultural, religious things. And because of a lot of that sort of other political activity beyond the sort of core goal, you have New York, I believe one of the districts in New York is investigating the NRA's nonprofit nonprofit status. And that's a real threat because we saw what happened to the Trump organization's nonprofit when they were investigated. It ended up having to be dissolved. And so these money issues are going to start to matter to the people in the organization as they look to move forward.
Well, Kimberly, I'm so glad you're here because I want to talk about the Fed.
Yay.
Before we go. And you're just the person
we
to talk to.
We love the Fed at Marketplace.
Well, you love the Fed. And America loved, I guess, a story about commentator and author Stephen Moore, who was loudly floated by this White House for an open seat on the Federal Reserve Board. His candidacy ran into some trouble. And then yesterday, just a few minutes after Stephen Moore said his nomination was a go and the White House was behind him, all of a sudden, no, they weren't. President Trump pulled the plug. Tell me about Stephen Moore and this episode by tweet, of course.
What stands out to me the most, so this is the second candidate in recent weeks that the Trump administration floated and then withdrew. Herman Cain was dealt a similar fate. What's interesting about Stephen Moore is that he has a much longer and stronger record than Herman Cain of speaking about economic policy. Much of it is incorrect, but nevertheless, he was a candidate that was floated very strongly by President Trump. And it even though many, many economists, and I talked to a lot of economists, and many even Republicans were very concerned about his economic record, it wasn't that actually knocked him down. It was those comments about women.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A. And Kimberly, what about just the way that Stephen Moore was cast overboard? He apparently was confident that it was all good and until it wasn't.
Well, it's hard in this environment to determine what's actually going to matter. We have a president of the United States on record with some really troublesome comments about women, to put it mildly. And so there would be reason for Stephen Moore to his argument was that, oh, these were jokes. They were in poor taste. I apologize. It's easy to understand why he might have thought that would not be what brought him down. And so, but over time, more and more members of the Senate said, look, we have a problem with his economic policies. We have a problem with what he's had to say about women. He's made racist jokes in the past as well that are now coming to light. We just don't want to do this.
And this is not an ambassadorship to a relatively small country somewhere. This is the Fed, and it's absolutely no joke. And I think a lot of senators got that sense as well. Well, before we go, we have one more bit of news that we want to make sure we cover. No one would dare put director John Singleton in a box. Sure, he made his name telling stories that reflected the black experience in America, like his debut film in 1991, Boys in the Hood.
Let's go. All right, wait a minute, man. Let's split up.
No, man, I don't think we should do that. I mean, if we got to throw some heads, I think it'd be better if we're together.
Oh, man, them fools ain't gonna want to do nothing, man. They're just showing up.
Cool. I'm out of here.
That movie earned John Singleton the distinction of being the youngest person ever nominated for Best Director at the Academy Awards. He was 23 years old. In a way, Boys in the Hood was like reading a diary entry of the director's life. Singleton was born and raised in Los Angeles. His parents shared custody, toggling Singleton between Pasadena and Inglewood, a community he displayed a deep love for on camera, even as he contended with the violent elements that put his neighbors in the crosshairs. The final tragedy we see in Boys in the Hood speaks to that love and that conflict, and you can feel Singleton imagining what might have happened had his fate met with a bullet before his potential was realized.
Ricky!
John Singleton thrived making films with majority black casts and centering black life, but no two movies in his catalog are alike. He followed Boys in the Hood with a romance called Poetic Justice, starring Janet Jackson and Tupac. Then there's the historical drama Rosewood, a remake of the blaxploitation classic Shaft, even an installment of one of the most popular film franchises of all time, Too Fast, Too Furious.
Why don't I just find y'all a fourth and we settle this on the streets, huh?
Bring him on.
Anybody I want.
Rilo.
No matter who it is.
Yeah.
Yo.
Yeah, man. You want to race tonight?
Yeah, you know I could use the money.
You got 4 minutes, man.
All right, I'll be there.
John Singleton took chances on actors by giving well-known names opportunities to star in meaty roles, from Tyra Banks to Busta Rhymes to Ice Cube, who starred in both Boys in the Hood and Higher Learning, an exploration of how racial and social politics play out in American college campuses.
You need to think about becoming mentally competitive. Being black does not free you from being a responsible individual.
Yeah, but being a responsible individual don't free you from being black. Now do it.
That's right. Poor misguided soul. You have yet to learn the rules of this game.
He will. I don't want to. See, I'm smart enough to know it's not my game to play. Just a pawn like everybody else.
Used intelligently, a pawn can create a checkmate, Mr. Williams, or become a very powerful player himself.
John Singleton died this week following a stroke that left him in intensive care. He was 51. As we head into the weekend, we remember his work and its impact on storytelling and casting in Hollywood. Let's listen to a song off the soundtrack for Boys in the Hood. This is Black on Black Crime by Stanley Clarke. I want to thank all my guests for being around the table today. Kimberly Adams is a correspondent for Marketplace. Great to have you, Kimberly.
Thanks, Todd.
Mark Fisher is senior editor at the Washington Post. Mark, thank you.
Good to be here, Tom.
Josh Gerstein, senior legal affairs contributor for Politico. Josh, have a great weekend.
Thanks a lot, Todd. Enjoyed it.
Thanks to y'all for being here. 1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the website at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Joshua Johnson is back in the chair on Monday. Thank you so much for being with us on this Friday. This is 1A.